good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is Tony, and you're listening to a brand new episode of Tales from the Couch Zone. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. I've got a bit of a sore throat, but I guarantee that this show will go over 2 minutes.
Oh, you too now. I don't know if you've been keeping up with all the comic conversation stuff, but the same thing happened to Alex for the last two weeks. But obviously, your sore throat is nowhere near as bad as his.
No. Well, or maybe I'm just a trooper. Maybe I'm just tougher.
Shots fired. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, if you have the X-Men theme humming in your head now, you can blame Dazza for that. All right, let's waste no more time. Speaking of the X-Men, Dazza, you brought up the news of what Fox seems to be lining up for the foreseeable future with their X-Men franchise, correct?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I wanted to talk about this a couple of weeks ago, but we sort of went on to other things and we did the Tarantino show. But it's there's sort of news coming through about sort of, you know, the direction of the Fox sort of their version of the Marvel movies, and it makes for some. There's been some interesting stories. First of all, there was a story a couple of weeks back, which we'll get to in a moment, which was that there is a possibility that they may actually be resetting the X-Men. Universe.
Didn't they just do that too?
Well, they didn't quite, because it was kind of, this was like the ones that we had was like a continuation of the actual, of what had already gone before. So the X-Men First Class was like a prequel, even though it didn't fit in quite perfectly. It was meant to be a prequel. And of course, X-Men and Days of Future Past actually tied those two franchises together. So we had one massive franchise, and then obviously X-Men Apocalypse, even though there was like a resetting direction of the timeline, it was still the same sort of character, so we still had that franchise. It would just gone on a sort of like a Star Trek style sort of, like, you know gone in a sort of, you know, a different direction, but still, you know, the franchise. It's not like going back to the beginning and resetting everything with new actors and new characters and sort of a new premise or anything. But there is talk that they're actually may go that direction. Apparently, how it sort of was mentioned is that they're working on the script with the possibility that Jennifer Lawrence, Michael Fassbender, will be basically coming back for a new movie. But their contracts are done. You know, the three of them, their contracts, James McAvoy as well as the third person, their contracts are done. So there's a possibility that they might not actually be coming back if they don't want to. Apparently, they have this sort of deal that they have between the three of them, is that none of them, is that basically, unless all three of them come back, none of them are coming back. Okay, so basically, like I said, I'll come back to my thoughts on that in a moment. But the interesting thing is the actual sort of the timeline that Fox have for their sort of movie calendars going forward. And again, this is very open to change. But the actual how it stands at the moment is obviously next March we're getting Logan. Now, from that point on, there's no more X-Men related movies for the rest of 2017. The next slot that they've got is for, and these are all untitled movies, the next slot they've got is for March 2018. Then there's one for November 2018, and then there's another one for March 2019. And at the moment, the films which are possible to fill those slots, they're working on Deadpool 2, which is one of the most, the most far along with. They're still sort of, you know, casting and stuff, but they've got a director, the guy who directed John Wick has basically just been brought in. So that one's the one the most far along with, and the shortlisting people for Cable and for Domino. You know, so you would expect that that would be the one which would fill the March 2018 slot. The other two that they're working on is New Mutants. And the one after that that they're working on is Deadpool 3, which apparently is going to be a Deadpool and X-Force movie. So if you at the moment, and again, this could change. At the moment, how it would stand would be Deadpool 2, you would think March 2018. The New Mutants one in November 2018, and then possibly Deadpool 3 X-Force 2 in 2019. Which at the moment, there is sort of like, there's no sort of, you know, slot for, or any sort of like, you know, firm plan of what the next actual X-Men movie would be. It all basically sort of, you know, depends on if there's, you know, if the three of them are coming back or anything like that. Personally, I'm personally in favour of the full reboot. And normally I'm not really into reboots and everything, but the thing is, to me, the way it's looking, this movie with Logan next year, if you sort of have trailers or anything to go by, that to me feels like an ending to the sort of, to the current X-Men saga. It's just got that vibe to it. There's like an, you know, apocalyptic end. They mentioned that all the mutants are gone and everything. So unless there's some sort of time travel type thing, I think that would be the perfect way to finish off, you know, that particular franchise, particularly because Wolverine is going to be the sort of, you know, for Martin, it looks like it's possible this might be his last movie. It would make sense for him to basically sort of to bow out in this manner. And then you can basically just sort of, you know, just do a reset, bring in new actors and take the premise, you know, back to the basics and restart the whole thing again. Because if you think I've not got the exact date on when the X-Men, the original one, came out. I think it was 2001, something like that. The point is, it's sort of been... Say again?
I believe 2000.
2000, right, okay. We're talking over 15 years ago. And when that film... superhero movies and comic book related movies have moved on so much since that film was actually made. I think the studios are a lot more confident to basically... take more from the source material, sort of, you know, do the sort of big story reliance, sort of do characters as they are in the comics. There's a lot more confidence to do that than there was in the, the X-Men, when that film came out. So to me, I think sort of, you know, reset the whole thing, give it sort of more of a sort of, you know, and also as well, I think studios, you know, they realize that you can basically get darker with these properties. You know, go into the whole sort of, you know, the angles of prejudice and everything and really get into that, you know, get really sort of, you know, have the whole thing of this sort of like, you know, this sort of underclass of, you know, of mutants who are basically being persecuted and everything, you know, really go on that. And also doing different interpretations of the, the characters. You don't have to do it. I'm not saying you should do an origin story again. But basically, you know, you can basically do this as maybe the, the second X-Men team getting together and reference the fact that there was a team, you know, before. Bring in a new Wolverine. Bring in a new Rogue. You know, have the Rogue who was basically, you know, the superpower, you know, powerhouse that she was, who could fly and everything like that, you know, but sort of... which we weren't going to do in the original X-Men, but, you know, sort of, you know, do that, you know, bring in sort of, you know, characters and have them closer to how they were in the comics. And I just think sort of, you know, just sort of, because they've got sort of, they've made this sort of so convoluted with the sort of, with the timelines and everything and sort of, and to me, X-Men Apocalypse was as well received. I personally thought the film was okay. You know, I liked it for the most part, but I have no desire to see Mystique, be the head of the X-Men again. You know, let's get that out of there. She was never in an X-Men properly in the comic. Let's go back to actually having the X-Men as they were, as we remember it, you know. So to, and you know, and Michael Fassbender was great as Magneto, you know, but basically sort of, you know, maybe it's time for, you know, another Magneto. Have sort of, you know, bring it back, you know. Let's have, you know, a sort of... The another thing about Apocalypse is that the new cast members that were brought in, who, because it's sort of, if you were sort of looking to that group be the ones who you're changing the guard with, I wasn't that enamored with them, to be honest. You know, I thought the Jean Grey girl was fine, but, you know, Cyclops didn't really sort of strike me. But they didn't really come across to me as this is the ones who could take the franchise into the future. You know, to me, I think just do a reset, a reboot, a restart, and take it from there. And you could sort of have the new mutants. You could have the new mutants film to basically sort of lead into that. You know, have the sort of, have it that basically this new team has been sort of, you know, and have the X-Men almost as if it's like mythical offstage, you know, team that are basically, you know, that you're sort of they're aspiring to be, which are almost legends. Maybe have it something that they've, you know, gone missing, and then maybe bring them in as sort of like a cameo towards the end or something to build on that. There's sort of possibilities, but I think just sort of, you know, start a whole thing fresh. And the great thing about it is that the Deadpool character, you know, those films, they can fit into either. You know, if you decide to basically continue his franchise, that, you know, that sort of character, that can basically fit into basically whichever direction, you know, they're going to go.
Yeah, I'm sort of torn, because I felt like, and you already addressed this to a degree, but I just felt like, you know, to a degree, First Class was sort of, not really a reboot, but sort of a starting of another franchise, but I felt like what followed after Days of Future Past was sort of their idea, sort of the a reboot going forward, maybe a soft reboot, and the idea that you're going to just so very quickly just... On the heels of Apocalypse, you're just going to do another reboot. Just because, obviously, I can't imagine they're going to come cheap, Jennifer Lawrence and Michael Fassbender. Those are going to be cheap, and it's one of these things to where I don't want them to reboot, but then at the same time, there is benefits to doing it as well. If you were to do a reboot of sorts, I would make sure to go out of my way to get a bunch of these great unknown actors that you can sign for maybe 6-7 pictures. That way, you know, for the foreseeable future that you can plan around them, and you have X amount of money that you already know that you've allocated towards paying these actors. And despite how well, or let's be honest, from what we've seen so far, how poorly they've done, or they haven't quite lived up to expectations. But then there's also the idea of, if you're going to reboot the X-Men, why not just make nice? Why not just eventually? Because it's going to happen eventually. Everybody knows it. Fox pretends like it's not going to happen, and I'm sure the internet's sort of lamenting because it hasn't happened already. But we all know it's going to happen eventually. Eventually, they're going to make nice with Marvel/Disney, and then I think if you want to get a rebooted X-Men, making nice with Disney is the best way to is the best excuse to use than any. And the idea you're going to use that synergy from the Marvel properties, the proper Marvel properties, if you can use that synergy like they're going to do with Spider-Man, it's like, why not just use that as your excuse to reboot? And then also at the same time, you're sort of revitalizing the franchise as well, because it's like, not only are you redoing the X-Men, but you're doing it with the idea that these are the X-Men that fit in the proper Marvel universe now, and going forward you're going to have all this goodwill towards the franchise. So even if you do, and the film just maybe isn't as good as you would hope it'd be, the fact that it had all this goodwill built up, and it's part of the Marvel movie property franchise, and the idea that you can get a couple of the stars maybe from the other films as well to help bolster the star power of the film, I think that'd probably be the way you want to go, because the idea that you're just going to reboot and you're still going to have that wall between yourselves and Marvel, that seems like, it's like you're just going to reboot again just because you have nothing else. You've tried to do it a couple of times and it hasn't really worked out. The idea of, well, it's going to work this time because X. And it's like, no, you've done that before and it hasn't worked. It's not the silver bullet that you thought it was going to be. You got to try something else. You got to think outside the box. I know you don't want to make nice for whatever reason why, but this is a business first and foremost. And these are public companies, but you have to imagine the people that work for the company. At the end of the day, they don't care. They don't care if if you're looking at a business agreement that maybe Marvel is getting more from it. It's at the end of the day, it's like, wouldn't you rather have a bigger piece of a smaller pie than a bigger piece of a smaller pie? That seems to make more sense. Just the idea of, okay, we're looking to reboot, and we've already seen what a business model looks like working with Marvel, and you know, Sony seems for the most part happy, so why not just go in that direction? Already, this is what the fans want, and you sort of have this ill will towards your product that you've rebooted this so many times, and the last couple of films haven't exactly set the world on fire. So I think the best way to go forward is just, okay, reboot. I'm not a super big fan of it, but the idea that you want to get Jennifer Lawrence, and I'm sure she's not going to come cheap after seeing how much she brings to these movies. It's like, okay, you want to reboot because you want a brand new cast and you don't want to deal with those expensive contracts. That's fine, but if you're going to reboot, at least reboot for a reason.
I personally don't care about Marvel getting the X-Men movies back.
But to me, that's the only way you can get me to care about a reboot of the X-Men. Because that's not saying I'm not totally sour on the idea of them doing the X-Men. But don't just do another reboot with the hopes of, oh, we'll get it right this time. Because you've done it you've done it twice now. You've done it with the First Class stuff. You were hoping that was going to be a reboot. And then the stuff that followed Days of Future Past was also a reboot of sorts. And so it's like you've tried it twice now and it's blown up in your face both times. What makes you think the third time's going to be any different? I'd think about it twice. Maybe they might get it this time. But we've seen it in X-Men Apocalypse. It's like, okay, they did it right with Deadpool. They could have easily screwed it up just like they screwed so many things up before in the past. But the fact that they nailed Deadpool, it's like, well, maybe they know what they're doing this time. Maybe they can actually pull together a pretty decent X-Men film. And then X-Men Apocalypse came out. And I know you liked it, but I thought it was underwhelming. I didn't think it was bad. I'm not gonna go out here and say it's bad because I think it's a little too strong. But I think it was just underwhelming. I think that's what most people's impressions of it going forward. I think it was just underwhelming, and the idea that you're just going to do a reboot and that's going to solve all your problems, I don't think that's the way to go. It's not so much the idea that you're making nice with Marvel and that's going to be what propelled you to make good X-Men movie. It's the idea that you sort of have this film franchise that has a little bit of ill will towards it. You want to at least help generate some interest in the franchise going forward. I think, and obviously you want to reboot. What better excuse to reboot than is, hey, we're going to make nice with Marvel. Hey, watch our films now, because now they're proper Marvel. It's like, you could still go with the directions that you want to do creatively, but at the same time, it's like, okay, you've made an attempt to sort of admit your past failures, and that going forward that you're maybe going to try something new, but the idea that you're just going to do a reboot just for the sake of doing a reboot, it's like, you've done it before. I've been burned twice. I don't think doing it a third time is going to be the charm. I think they got to think outside the box for this reboot.
Yeah, like I was saying, I'm not bothered about I personally like the idea of having the X-Men movies separate. I always personally thought that the X-Men comics, I thought with the themes that they were sort of, you know, pushing the whole sort of, you know, the prejudice, the fact that people with superpowers were being hunted and everything. I always thought that was sort of, it would have been better to have the two universes separate, which they actually did for a short time in the whole sort of like, the Reborn stuff that they did, which was pretty awful. But I actually thought the idea of it, of having the two things separate, you know, was a good idea. And also, it's sort of, if they were to sort of like lump in with Marvel, does that mean we're going to sort of get... I personally don't think the whole thing would work. I think with Fox and Marvel, I think it worked with Sony because they basically had one film, they had one franchise, one character that they basically didn't really know how to make the best of, and that sort of benefited them all around. I think sort of trying to shoehorn all the X-Men things into the whole Marvel thing would just be overkill. I personally, you know, it would be great to have seen, you know, in the prime, I mean, sort of like Hugh Jackman in there with the Avengers and that sort of thing. But, you know, we're sort of past that now. We're not going to get that. And I personally think that, you know, sort of change the look, change the tone, maybe go for a grittier side than what they've been doing. Maybe sort of go, not quite the R rating that they did with Deadpool, but basically sort of, you know, go more for that sort of like, you know, that action, that most sort of grounded action orientated, you know, don't go for the big sort of superhero, big flashing thing in the sky that's basically destroying everything that they did with Apocalypse, you know, sort of go for a more grounded approach. And you know, that to me could be something that, you know, that they could go with. But I'm just sort of, I don't think that sort of, you know, I personally, if they ever get the X-Men back at Marvel, I think it's going to be a long way down the road. Basically because for the property, you know, but it's not just the X-Men movies which are important to this property, but you saw how much money they made out of Deadpool. You know, and I'm sort of banking that we probably can do the same with the New Mutants and with the X-Force movie and stuff. There is so much, basically, property that the X-Men thing brings with it that they can make profitable. You know, so I personally don't... I personally think that there's a chance that you might get Fantastic Four back at Marvel, because I think, you know, there's a chance that Fox are basically, you know, would be quite sort of like, you know, sort of, you know, be able, okay on doing a deal with, and I quite like to see that. I'm not particularly bothered about seeing the X-Men get back to the Marvel Universe, and I'm not real sure that it's sort of that it is going to happen anytime soon, frankly.
I'm just then to me the idea then going forward is you've made the bed, stick with the cast you got. It's maybe try to, I guess, thematically try to make the films different, but don't do the reboot then. To me, I would just use that as if the day ever comes where you decide you want to make nice with Marvel, then that's when you do the reboot. You've made your bed. Doing a reboot isn't going to be a silver bullet. Then just go with the continuity you have now and just hoping the movies are better in the future. Because really, the idea that you're going to do a reboot and that's sort of going to be the solution to all your problems going forward. It's like, if you want to make the gritty movies like you're talking about now, we've seen in Logan, at least from the trailer, it's like they could still do it and keep the continuity they have right now. So there's no big rush, I feel, to do a reboot. If you want to do thematically different films, you can do that. But at the same time, I don't want that on top of a reboot because it's too much. I think it's too much to ask for, and it's the idea that, okay, we'll get it right this time. It's like you've demonstrated before in the past that isn't going to be – that's the quick fix isn't going to work this time. Hot-shotting it and the idea of that's going to be the thing that fixes all the problems with the franchise. It's like, okay, you've shown to me that that's not the way to go. So just live with the decisions you've made, pay the actors that you've made, these exorbitant amount of, I'm sure what they're going to probably ask for is going to be a lot. Just go with it and just maybe try to make better films. It's like, I guess it's the only thing they could do. Cause to me, I think they're going to rest their hat on just rebooting the franchise and hope that helps people think twice about the X-Men franchise where it's like, okay, I have no faith in you guys doing this again.
I just don't want to see Jennifer Lawrence back in a prominent role in these movies. she totally phoned it in the thing. I think, maybe if they don't do a reboot, then I don't really see where this current direction goes. Because I say, people that bought in to me aren't sort of, they're not sort of, I can't see them sort of growing into the caliber that they're enough to carry the movie. And frankly, the ones who are basically maybe the star, even Michael Fassbender, who was good in it, but it wasn't, I didn't think he was as, and part of it is probably the sort of the actual, the role he was sort of given of, is this sort of, in that film. It didn't blow me away like it done in the other two films. I just get the impression that they sort of basically maybe, and the fact that they've got this thing where they basically come as a free or nothing at all, leads me to think that they're sort of like, ready to move on anyway. Jennifer Lawrence certainly, she's basically, she's above this sort of nonsense now. She's basically making Oscar movies. So I personally just don't think, I personally, don't see any future in what they've got now.
Okay, let's say you do that then. You do the reboot. You get a brand new cast in there, bunch of young faces that we never seen before, and they all come cheap, and they all sign up for these movies for, I guess, obviously all the tie-ins they're going to do eventually, the X-Forces and the Deadpools, and they can sprinkle them in all the films in the franchises that they have going forward with new means and whatnot. Let's say they do the reboot and it's just as bad. You still have the same people at the helm, the executives at Fox. They're still calling all the shots. So they do a reboot and it's still bad. What then?
Well, carry on with the other one. Where's that going to go? To me, don't just get like new actors in. Don't necessarily go for young ones. Like I say, you don't have to do an origin story. Bring in some sort of have this sort of like, an X-Men halfway through their careers and bring in some established good actors and everything to fill those roles. Because Bryan Singer is pretty much he's not going to be involved anymore. Bring in some fresh. Some fresh approach, creatively bringing fresh directors, bringing fresh special effects people, don't just reboot the actors, reboot everything, make this an actually complete and utter, reboot, right? In all senses of the word and see where it goes. That would be my thing, and see what happens. But and maybe then if it doesn't work, then maybe sort of start, thinking. But even if they basically make, the thing is, even if they were to basically try and make another X-Men team movie and that one didn't work, they've still got the other properties that, that they can be doing, the good stuff with. The Deadpool, they've hit gold there, and hopefully, we'll basically sort of Deadpool 2 will be great. They can keep, they can have X-Force as another, as another franchise, which will basically fit in with the Deadpool style that they've gone. The New Mutants that they've got, they can do something really, really different with that. Apparently, the approach is going to be like a young adult thing. Even if they've got like the X-Men team that basically just for every reason doesn't work, they've still got the other things that they can play with. They can, they can basically sort of like retry to do the Gambit thing. because that's still there. It's not worked out yet, but there's a possibility to do like more of like, say, a heist type movie if you get the right person in there. There's enough with the other properties that even if the X-Men team fails to be something that they basically have to do, they can basically carry on with all the other stuff, and sort of like build a franchise, perfectly, around there.
Well, I'm with the idea of, obviously, I think you sort of misunderstanding when I said because I don't know all the details of the Sony Marvel deal, but for the most part, as far as I know, Sony still owns the rights to the Spider-Man franchise, aren't I? Aren't they just working?
Yeah, they do.
They have some kind of working deal that they can play nice with Spider-Man, but at the same time, they still own the rights. It's like, why not just do that with X-Men? It's like, the Marvel movies that would have the X-Men films, obviously Marvel would be calling the shots there, but then let Fox do whatever they want on their films. I mean, obviously do the tie-in, do the rub, and obviously you'd get a couple of stars in those films. But then just let Fox still call the shots of what goes on in those movies.
I don't know. The thing is, the deal with Sony is that it's basically a two-way street, is that they have a say in how Spider-Man is used in the Marvel movies.
I wouldn't be opposed to that, because we've seen so far that Fox is, aside from Deadpool, has demonstrated that they have no idea what they're doing as far as these films are concerned.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I'm done.
I'm done, guys. I'm done.
Yeah, I'm done. I just think there's whatever the deal is that they've got with Sony. I just think that I don't know. I personally don't see the sort of like the X-Men and Marvel thing just getting together anytime soon. I think it would basically the whole thing would have to come to a stage to me where the X-Men franchise as a whole just didn't become sort of profitable enough for Fox to basically want to keep going with. And even though Apocalypse sort of like faded somewhat, Deadpool was massively profitable in insanely when you consider how much we actually spent to make it. Logan, the signs look good for that, the trailer and everything, so we'll see from there. But I think it would have to really, really tank for them to do a deal. Fantastic Four absolutely was a bombed massively in every sense of the world, and they, at the moment, they're still hanging on to that. They're still not sort of like you would have thought that after the last Fantastic Four movie we would have said to Marvel, look, just take the bloody thing, just get this, do what you want with it, we don't care. But even that, they're still like clinging on to it just to see if they can. And I don't think they'll ever actually make a film. I think they'll just let eventually the rights will just sort of slip. But they're still they're not giving it up, quite yet. So we'll see. But I think this dream collaboration between the two, I think it's a long way, a long way off, frankly. We're not going to get that Secret Wars movie that Ed in San Antonio thinks we're going to get one day.
Well, and I don't think we're – I think even in an ideal scenario with Fox, I don't think we'd get that. I think at very most you'd have a cameo sort of reminiscent of what they did in Spider-Man and Civil War. I think that's the most we'd ever get as far as the X-Men being in the Marvel franchise. It's like, okay, I can live with that, with the idea of – you're rebooting for a reason because you've made nice with Marvel now, And that's, I guess, a way to sort of remedy all the ill will that they've created with the movie going public as well as the comic book fans. Like, just try. And like you said, with the Spider-Man deal, it's like they still retain the rights to the film. They obviously would get a large percentage of the film going forward. But at the same time, it's like, okay, why not just let Marvel call a couple of the shots? Because you've demonstrated so far, it's like, a Deadpool aside, you've pretty much dropped the ball, at least for the last couple of years. Why not just try something new with a new creative outside of your influence?
Well, Days of Future Past was good.
It was good. It was good, but I wouldn't say great.
I'd say it was great.
I would say it was good. I wouldn't go that far.
I would say great. I thought it was sort of like a really quite daring and imaginative, and I think it worked. You know, when you everyone was sort of like, that was one where everyone was saying, oh, it's too much. You're never going to get this into money. There's too many characters. You've too many sort of plot lines going on. This is going to be a mess. And I thought we did an absolutely admirable job of putting the whole thing together, you know, and to be honest, I actually came out of that thinking that this is basically going to be, you know, a great thing for the franchise moving forward, because we've sort of reset everything into a path, and I just don't think that they sort of made enough of it with X-Men Apocalypse, personally.
I'm just the idea that you still have the same people calling the shots, so you may get various degrees of film. It's like, at the same time, I want new people at the helm, and it doesn't even necessarily need to be Marvel/Disney. You could bring somebody else, and just have somebody else calling the shots, because at this point, it's like, I have no faith in them. Like, none. Yeah. I've been burned a couple of times now, and I'm ready to move on. You could tell me, you can promise me all these things, and obviously Deadpool to a degree was the exception to that rule, but it's just like, I'm done. I want something from new with these characters, and if you keep doing the idea with the idea that the reboot is going to be the solution to all your problems, I've seen it before, and I've seen them drop the ball, so I have no reason to believe a reboot would fix the franchise going forward. All right, since we're talking all things film, let's move on to our regularly scheduled segment. Let's do Rate and Slate. We've made our way through we started through the 80s, and this episode we're going to wrap up the 90s with 1999's top 10 films according to TKO170.com. All right. Wait. What?
I'm just anticipation of the top 10 for 1999.
Yeah,
I've seen the list.
They're not all winners. Unlike the early 90s, which had Sophie's Choice as far as what we're going to pick as far as our rate. As we've seen, as the 90s have gone on, the pickings have become slimmer and slimmer. So let's start at number 10, Austin Powers, Spy Who Shagged Me. I thought it was Spy Who... Oh, there we go. Yes, Spy Who Shagged. Okay. Number 9, The World Is Not Enough. Number 8, American Beauty. Number 7, Notting Hill. Number 6, The Mummy. Number 5, Tarzan. Number 4, The Matrix. Number 3, Toy Story 2. Number 2, The Sixth Sense. And at number 1, The Phantom Menace. Now... Rate's going to be kind of difficult this week, but I can see us going in various directions when it comes to Slate.
Right.
but before we go into the negative, we were talking X-Men and how maybe they could revitalize the franchise. Let's try to keep that positivity going forward. And Dazza, what's going to be your rate for 1999?
Okay, well, my rate for 1999... And this is one of those years where it's slim pickings. But there's actually no film on there that I look at, and it is one that I absolutely loved and adored.
Really,
the one that I would pick for my rate would be the Matrix. And this is a film that basically I think it sort of although people remember it really really fondly and really great, I think the later films really sort of hurt this. As a franchise, but if we just talk about, you know, the first movie, the Matrix, it was a film that you had not really seen before. You know, the style in it was great. All those special effects and those sort of, like, you know, those really sort of, you know, weird, almost Hong Kong related type action scenes and stuff, and all the slow motion and everything. But even put those to one side, to me, it was a really really good story there. And the whole sort of concept that they have of this, basically sort of like this, you know, this world within a world sort of thing. I think the story was quite complex and, you know, and really interesting and everything. And the sort of, you know, the fact that everyone's sort of, you know, tuned into this sort of like this mythical realm and using that against this sort of like, you know, this evil power that was enslaving them. I think it was like a really, really good story there. And apart, you know, there was a lot of substance behind the style. So that is one I will pick. I never loved it as much as other people did, but when at the time people just went absolutely ape for this movie, it was like, you know, the really, really big thing at the time. But the sequels to it were just absolutely dull and dreadful. It was something that I think you really know you need to make one movie out of. And this, as we sort of come into the sort of 90s and sort of look at the list going forward, you do start to see this is where like franchises really started to sort of like become the norm. At one point there was basically franchises would sort of happen if there was basically a film that sort of lent itself to that. Whereas we're sort of getting to a stage now where every time a film did really, really well, immediately you had to have a sequel. You know, but if you look on this list, you know, but The Mummy is quite, you know, a fun Indiana Jones type sort of knockoff. But it's, you know, it's a film that, you know, you can watch on like a Sunday afternoon and it'd be a bit of fun and everything. But it wasn't something that you needed to make sequels of. You know, the story was fair. And it seems to be that we get to a stage round about this time where everything would sort of be, you know, once it was made and did really well, if they could, they would do a sequel.
Yeah. I think.
Well, while you're thinking, can I just ask because the Pierce Brosnan James Bond films always sort of start to fade into each other with me. The World Is Not Enough. Is that the one with the guy with a bullet in his head?
Let's see. I think it is. That sounds like it's the one. Let's see. Yes, I believe so. I'm looking at the film right now, and I do believe that is the.
Because I want to mention, because I believe that is the one where the Bond girl is called Christmas, and you've got the worst line in a Bond film ever right at the end. Do you remember this?
No.
Right. Okay. Basically, the in The World Is Not Enough. The Bongo, the character's name is called Christmas.
Christmas and Jones.
But
it's, they could have not picked a more preposterous last name.
No. But the Denise Richards who plays her. And as is customary for James Bond movies, it basically ends with James Bond basically shagging his Bond girl. And afterwards, the scene it finishes on, obviously they've just had sex. And Pierce Brosnan just said, "And I always thought Christmas came once a year."
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, even by James Bond standards, that's pretty terrible.
Yeah, that is like sort of just, yeah.
Wow. I need to sit down. Not that I wasn't already, but I need to sit down now.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's why they rebooted the James Bond films after that. I have to say that
I thought there was another entry after this. I thought there was
There was. But okay. I was just being facetious. But yeah, it's yeah. But I know I've gone off a tangent here and that, but I just thought I just had to bring that one up. And incidentally, that was a bad James Bond film as well, because the whole thing, I believe, was about sort of an oil pipeline. It's like that's the main plot and everything. It was this is shit.
Yeah, it seems like we're naturally progressing towards Slate. Do you want to just go into that now? Because I feel like we're already...
No, I want to see you pick one to rate out of this list. You're not getting off easy.
Okay, well, for me, there's actually a couple of films like I probably could have gone with. Obviously, not my cup of tea, but I can sort of respect to a degree. Obviously, I think time has not been nice to this film as far as I feel like it sort of exposed this film, but I still say it's a pretty decent movie, American Beauty. Obviously not my pick, but something I'm willing to at least say is honorable mention. This extends obviously to a lesser degree, but for me, it came down to two films. It came down to Toy Story 2 and The Matrix. Also, actually, you know what? Another notable entry would also be Tarzan. I remember that film, 1999, was actually pretty good. But for me, it's going to come down between Toy Story 2 and The Matrix. And God bless Toy Story 2. I think it's a fantastic film. Thumbs up. Huge thumbs up. I'm going to agree with you, and I'm going to have to go with The Matrix as well. Just because it's one of these films that just came out of nowhere. Nobody saw it coming. It's one of these films that just completely caught everybody off guard. It's this fantastic action movie that, I guess, even to this day, you kind of see its influence in all these other films going forward. And obviously, you would get the sequels, and I thought 2 was fine. But I think the reason why I don't like the franchise as well is because 3 was bad, but also the way it was presented, or at least the both 2 and 3, they built off one another. So I felt like 3 was so bad that it retroactively ruined 2. So when it comes to The Matrix, I sort of take it as a standalone picture, and this is what we're really doing here as far as rating film from 1999. So we're not really taking this on the franchise value, all the things that would come from it. We're just looking at the film, 1999's The Matrix, and if you have to pick me, at least my opinion, that's what Raiden Slay has been. It's not always been necessarily what's been the best film, but it's just whatever we thought was our pick, and I'm going to go with The Matrix, because God bless Toy Story 2. Obviously, I'm one of these people that don't think Pixar walks on water. I think obviously we've seen that they can make mistakes, but the Toy Story franchise, and eventually we'd see. I always thought 3 was the better entry, but I'm sort of going back on my role. It's like I'm willing to put Matrix in a vacuum, but for some reason, why Toy Story 2? But I think on its own merit, Toy Story 2, while a great movie, I'm of the opinion that The Matrix just barely edges out Toy Story 2, and that's why it's going to be my pick. It's one of these films where it's really, obviously, in the decades that would follow this movie, you'd see the influence it everywhere, and I even still, I would say to a degree, you still sort of see that in 2016, and then going forward, I think this was sort of a film that revolutionized the action industry, so, and I'm going to have to go with that with my rate for 1999.
Cool. I have to admit, I have never seen Toy Story 2 and 3. And part of the reason, I've seen Toy Story 1, which I love. Part of the reason is I don't think I can bear to watch them. Because was one of the Toy Story films I just happened to catch, I don't know if it was 2 or 3, I caught the bit where it's the story about the little cowgirl toy. Mm-hmm. And how she was sort of all loved by the kid. And eventually she basically got discarded. When the girl started to grow up and she started to discover lipstick and boys and stuff, and then she ended up being like put in the box to send down to the sort of like, you know, the second hand store and everything, and just the whole thing about that just broke my heart, and I just couldn't. From that point on, there's no way I can sit through Toy Story 2 and 3.
Then thank God you never sat through 3, because there's a scene. Obviously, it's not. That's not really that per se, but it's sort of something also very sad. And it's like, okay, I think these films may not be for Dazza then. Obviously, these are lighthearted family movies, and kids can watch this and not get too bummed out. But yeah, I know what you're saying as far as, you know, it's these films that obviously they're meant to appeal to the family, so they have to have something there for the adults as well. But yeah, there are times where it's like it gets really brutally sad.
I know. It's like we've got this nice sort of life being toys and everything. Why can't we just, like, you know, carry on with that? Why do we have to, you know, the kids have to go to college and basically stuff? It's just, you know, why can't things just stay nice? Cause don't grow up.
Because adults are
toys, rest of your life.
Because adults are gritty and sad, and they have to introduce that into their films.
Because
that's the only thing that'll appeal towards adults. All right. I forget, from here, do we go Best Picture or do we do after Rate and Slate?
We do the Rate and Slate first, and then we go through the list.
Sorry, it's been so long, Dazza, since we've done it.
Then we do the Best Picture and the Razzies.
It's been a whole 2 weeks since we've done Rate and Slate. I've long since forgotten. All right, Dazza, now You could go in various directions in here. You'd probably be right. So I'm curious what's going to be your slate for these top 10 films in 1999?
Okay. Well, as much as I've basically already slagged off A World is Not Enough. The one I'm going to pick, and to be honest, it's not a film that I necessarily really, really dislike, but it kind of represents something that sort of, you know, went south for me movie-wise. And that is The Phantom Menace. I sort of remember getting excited that the sort of a Star Wars thing was back, and it was going to be, we're going to see the whole sort of how the Empire rose, and we're going to see, you know, Darth Vader when he was young and his fall to the dark side. I had so much hope and expectation. I remember the day I went to see this film because I got my ticket beforehand, and I basically, my car basically sort of broke down and had to go into the garage.
An omen of things to come.
Yes. Maybe people were trying to tell me something. And I actually, I remember, because the cinema I went to was quite a city away. So I remember basically sort of like, you know, having to like, you know, ask my dad if he'd come and pick me up outside the cinema afterwards, because I got the train there, but by the time the film was finished, the train, you know, so I had to, you know, get my dad involved, but because there was no way that I couldn't not see this film on the opening night. I just had to. And it, like I say, I don't think it's necessarily the worst of the Star Wars film. The prequels were basically sort of, you know, really, really poor. But I think it's just sort of, you know, this film set the tone of what the prequels are going to be. And the one thing that I always remember, which I never thought I would get from a Star Wars movie, is that, and I remember the moment. It's the moment where Qui-Gon is talking to little Anakin, and they're basically talking, he's talking to Anakin's mother. And she's done this talk about the whole virgin birth thing, and we're talking about midichlorians. And I actually remember sitting there and suddenly realizing that I was getting bored. And the thing is, in the Star Wars movies, you've never time to get bored. Because, you know, to me, everything is sort of, you know, everything is gearing towards an action spot. Even Return of Jedi, which isn't my favorite by a stretch, and I think of the original three is the basically, you know, the poorest. It's a drop in quality. Even with all the Ewok nonsense and everything, you know, you never get bored in it. And yeah, in The Phantom Menace, I found I was getting bored. I think it also became, the thing is about what I loved about the Star Wars things, particularly as a kid, is they weren't condescending to you. They were basically, even as a kid, you were watching adults on screen. There was the little comedy thing with the two droids and everything, but generally speaking, it felt like this was a grown-up movie. Phantom Menace basically is, you know, what we basically like to call the family movies, where families can enjoy them. You know, like the Indiana Jones movies, families can enjoy them. In Phantom Menace, you started to have the trappings of what sort of like a kid's movie would be. You had Jar Jar Binks as like, you know, the over-the-top comedy thing, you know. You had basically little Annie, you know, you had a kid who was basically flying around, you know, shooting things in his spaceship. And, you know, he was the one that basically, in Star Wars, you have the whole Death Star sort of like, you know, thing that you had to bring down. In Phantom Menace, you have this spaceship that was controlling everything, but basically got shot by accident because the kid was just pressing buttons, and, you know, it was just, it just was sort of, it took the Star Wars franchise into a direction that I sort of didn't, you know, want it to go. And you know, there was good things about it. I think the score was absolutely phenomenal. You know, I still, you know, the one thing I think that, you know, for the most part in the Star Wars prequel is that the score was still like, you know, sort of was, you know, still excellent. I think, you know, the Darth Maul was a good looking character, even if he didn't really sort of get to do a great deal with him. But it was just so much, and the look of it, it's it's so soulless, because most of and I think the actors seem very awkward in a lot of it, because they're basically, even in pretty much everything is CGI. And not just sort of like the aliens or the action scenes or anything like that. The stuff where they're basically just like, you know, walking down like a corridor, and it's all, you know, they didn't build sets or anything. They just had like, you know, CGI and everything. And it just feels really, really soulless and without any depth. And I just think it's like, you know, it was a massively, you know, disappointing film. It's just, you know, it's, and the whole thing with, I mean, the pod, a lot of it felt, the best way I can describe how I felt like watching Phantom Menace is it felt like George Lucas showcasing what he could do special effects wise. It was like he had an idea. It was almost he had these ideas for sort of scenes without a story. It was like, you know, what'd be great is if we had sort of an old fashioned chariot race, but with spaceships and everything, that would be awesome. So you have this like sort of 10, 15 minute segment of sort of basically racing. It becomes like a sport movie and everything. It's just, but just so much of it in this film, I just think was sort of, it was just so much of it that was just sort of, it was just, you know, showing off. There was no sort of like, you know, real warmth to it at all. I mean, Samuel Jackson, I was so, when I heard that Samuel Jackson was going to be a Jedi in these movies, I was thinking, this is going to be awesome. And his character is so bland. You know, it's just a really bland sort of, you know, character. I just think the whole thing, and the thing is, as poor as and disappointing as some of this film was, it will get worse. You know, it was sort of, you know, and that, which I will come to in a few years' time. Don't worry about that. In a few weeks' time, I will come to. But yeah, Phantom Menace, it was just like, you know, a massive disappointment.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, I don't know about you, Dazza, when you exited the theater and the weeks that would follow, I convinced myself it was a good movie. Were you one of those people where you walked out of the film and maybe because it was Star Wars and had all this hype built around it and the fact that it just wasn't, you know, complete garbage, you sort of justified it to yourself like, I guess that was a good movie. I guess I liked it. Were you one of those people that, or did you know right from the get-go that this film was terrible and that you hated it and that it was a bad film?
No, I meant to say this actually. You hit it 100% on the head. I came away. I went to see it twice. I went to see it again a week later to try and come. And I sort of knew that it wasn't that great, but I was trying to convince myself that this was an awesome film because I'd been so invested in it because I'd bought some of the figures. I've probably still got it somewhere. I bought the Samuel Jackson figure, the Qui-Gon figure, the Obi-Wan figure, the I might have even bought the Jar Jar figure. I definitely bought the Darth Maul figure. You know, I bought the figures like I did when I was a kid. I was so invested in this. And when I went to see it the second time, I think I was even more sort of uneasy about it because I sort of knew the direction it was going and everything. It's just so, yeah, it was the sort of the Star Wars, you know, the wanting to basically believe that I was actually, you know, I'd really enjoyed it. I did try to convince myself that, you know, yes, I had enjoyed this film. And again, I don't think it's necessarily as awful as what a lot of people say, but I don't think it's a good film at all. And I have to say this, and please, you know, if you ever listen to one thing that I ever say to my, it is this. If you have never seen the Star Wars movies, or you want to be, you have kids of your own, and you want to introduce them to the wonder that is the Star Wars movies, do not watch them episodes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, don't watch them in that order. Because some people do. Don't do that. It doesn't, you know, and on TV as well, that when we have like a Star Wars marathon, you know, if they sort of have them all like in the same day or they'll have them week by week, they always show them like episode 1 and then 2 and 3. It doesn't work as a narrative. You know, because the whole thing about Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back and Return is you are basically, everything rests on basically the revelations that Luke discovers as he goes along. So finding out that Vader's his father, and finding out that basically Obi-Wan lied to it and all that sort of thing. If you watch the prequels, that basically ruins all of that for you. And you can't watch if you were to watch it that way, you can't watch Star Wars Empire Strikes Back the same way knowing those revelations. And knowing that basically Luke and Leia are brother and sister, You know, it just does not work. And knowing that Obi-Wan, when he's sort of, it just, none of it works. He has to be, if you need to watch the prequels, and I personally think you can basically get away with not watching the prequels, but if you do, you need to watch it, either 4, 5, 6, and then go back to the prequels. Or what you can do is you can watch 4 and 5, and because then you've got the revelation, and then watch 1, 2, 3, and then 6. Because that actually does work, because you basically, you found out pretty much almost everything you need to know after Empire Strikes Back. So you can basically then look back at the Vader story and see where he got from, and then go into Return of the Jedi. So that does actually work. And that does actually pay off, believe it or not. But this one, revelation, because at the end of Empire Strikes Back, you know Vader's Luke's father.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you don't know at that point that Leia is his sister.
Mm-hmm.
So if you watch the prequels after Empire Strikes Back, you basically get Luke born, and then it's, oh my God, you've got a sister, and the sister's Leia. You know, so if you were to basically not ever know anything about Star Wars and watch it that way, there is actually a payoff by watching the prequels. But you know, and then because when in Return of the Jedi, when Luke finds out that Leia's his sister, it's kind of done in a fairly underwhelming way. A
little bit.
It's just kind of like you have a sister.
I think they wanted to up the ante that they did in Empire Strikes Back, and I think the only thing they had was to make Luke and Leia brother and sister, and I feel like it didn't pay off.
Yeah, but like I said, at least, if you basically watch the prequels before you watch Return of the Jedi, you basically got that big revelation at the end, which is quite, you know, quite a cool one. It's like, you know, if you were to not know that, which how you can actually go into the Star Wars films and not know these things is beyond me. But if you were to do that, that would be a pretty cool, you know, revelation. But yeah, it's sort of, you know, the fact that they basically sort of like found out their brother and sister and never went, uh-oh.
You know, we kissed on
the Death Star.
You know what my recommendation film order is?
Go on.
Episodes 4, 5, and 6.
Yeah, I agree with that. but we will revisit the prequels.
Yeah, unfortunately, if we're going to keep this thing going, eventually we're going to make our ways to episode 2 and 3, so... I'm not looking forward to those days, but those are quite a few weeks away.
What? I'm looking forward. I like a good rant.
You're the one. I think this is another thing where I'm probably going to piggyback off you, because there's so many ways I could go with this. Obviously, I'm not a big fan of The Mummy or as a heterosexual male, Notting Hill. And but by all means, The World Is Not Enough is not a great film by any stretch of the imagination. But the glaring one you can't ignore, and the easiest case you can make, and like we mentioned earlier, you could make a great case for The World Is Not Enough. But it's one of those films to where I saw it once and I have no recollection of the film. Obviously, there's things here and there that I remember of it. But for me, my slate, I'm going to go with You Again, just like I did in Rate. I'm going to go with The Phantom Menace. It's one of these films to where, like I mentioned earlier, it's just funny how just the general moviegoers public, or just the public in general, sort of they saw this film and they didn't want to admit to themselves, or they didn't think about it enough. But it's like, you know what? That was a bad film. That was a bad outing at the film, and like that was a bad entry to the Star Wars franchise. And it would get worse before it would get better. I'm one of these people. Well, I'll save it for a later episode. But it's one of these things where it was a big disappointment, but it was one of those things where it had so much hype into it. All these toys, obviously, like you mentioned earlier, video games. I think they had a promotional tie-in with Pepsi that I remember. It's just like there was so much invested in this film being great. And obviously it's Star Wars, so it's been a while since they had the Star Wars, I guess a new Star Wars film. I guess they had the special edition that they re-released in theaters, and that was sort of my entry to the films. But it's like, after that, it's like, wow. It's a big letdown, and it would get worse before it would get better. It was one of those things to where it took a couple of weeks and even months for people to realize it. But I think, and it sort of is unfair to episode 2 as far as it should have came in with a clean slate. But by the time episode 2 came around, everybody realized just how bad a film it was. And that sort of poisoned the well. And had Star Wars episode 2 been good, I feel like it would have suffered because of how bad 1 was. But yeah, it's one of those things where it's just... It's basically what you expect from a Hollywood sequel, even though it was a prequel. It's like everything you would, I guess, textbook-wise do, bigger, badder, better CGI, better practical effects, better everything. But for some reason why, you can't just throw money at it and expect for something to be good. It still needs to be fun. The script and the actor's performances need to be there. And it wasn't in this film. I felt like especially Lucas here, but I'm obviously referring to just Hollywood in general. It's like they'll just throw money at a film and just expect because it's a sequel it'll do better. But it's one of these things where, yeah, it's you still need the good elements of a film for it to be good. Obviously, those things can help, special effects and big names, but at the end of the day, you need a solid script. You need a great director, obviously. God bless George Lucas. Episodes 4 and 2. I don't believe he directed 5, or he had a hand in directing 5, I believe.
No, he produced, and so I think he co-wrote 5 and 6, okay. But he didn't direct them.
So
he was overseeing them, but it was other people who basically came in. I mean George Lucas, the one thing you basically have to give George Lucas credit for, and why you can't basically sort of dismiss him totally out of hand because of what happened to the prequels, is that, you know, without him, we never would have had Star Wars. And if you have there is a book called The Untold Story of Star Wars, which is basically, if you sort of saw the things that he had to do to get Star Wars made, you know, it was an incredible achievement, you know, what he did on that level. But the problem is that it's one of these things that it's almost like a, The thing about sort of, we said this before, you know, when you have adversity, it makes you more creative to get over sort of, you know, these, you know, the problems and everything. In Phantom Menace, he basically had the technology and basically the freedom to do just what he wanted. And unfortunately, when you have that, it just didn't work. That was his sort of, his 100% vision. And it did, you know, and it just didn't work. I think another thing as well that is sort of about the Phantom Menace that basically sort of was that you really, I don't think really appreciated in the original Star Wars films until it was gone, was the dynamic that you had and the charm of the characters, you know, of sort of like, you know, Han Solo and Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill, that sort of that unit. And obviously even like the characters, like the, you know, the comedy characters, C-3PO and R2-D2 and you know, you had Chewbacca. All of those characters were just so endearing. You know, you saw one film with them and you wanted more. Whereas, you know, you look in Phantom Menace and there's absolutely no one that you can really take to heart. You know, Qui-Gon is just sort of, there's a great actor, but there's nothing really sort of massively cool about him or anything. The only character who you can sort of look at to me and think that you want to see more would be Darth Maul, because he's just sort of, he looks so great and everything, and just sort of, but again, that's sort of all on the surface. You just sort of, you know, there's nothing really under that. You've just sort of, in Phantom Menace, it's just like, it's just frankly charmless. And there's nothing really, there's no one that you really want to see more of. There's no one who you would sort of imagine kids. When I was a kid, everyone would basically, you know, argue who they wanted to play when we're playing Star Wars. You know, everyone wanted to be Han Solo, or some of his fans wanted to be Luke Skywalker or Chewie. I can't really see that there's anything in there that you'd want to be as a kid. But that's that.
Yeah. But before we move on to Best Picture, obviously, there's the gimmick, and I kind of want to do it this year as well, where you sort of have the notable entries here. I'm looking at the TKO 170 list right
there
here.
There are some good ones.
There are a few good films in this bunch. Obviously, number 50, South Park, Bigger, Longer, Uncut, cannot be unmentioned. Yeah. Let's see what else is on this. For some reason, I'm not one of these people, but maybe you can help explain to me. Explain to me the appeal, and I don't know if you can explain it to me. Galaxy Quest? It's one of these films sort of came and went, but now I hear all these people rant and rave about how great this film is.
I love Galaxy Quest.
Explain it to me, and for our listeners that don't quite get it.
The thing is, I think it's... I personally love it as a sci-fi fan because it's one of these things that it spoofs. It's basically a spoof on the Star Trek style. It's basically, you know, because Galaxy Quest is basically Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sort of like everything from a Captain Kirk character to the alien sort of psychic, and that whole dynamic of what they were like behind the scenes mirrors what you sort of, what we know about those sort of characters. The fact that they've all ended up doing conventions and stuff. I think it's sort of it's a spoof on that, but also, you know, or endearingly so. It's not an out-and-out sort of slaughter job of sci-fi movies. It's basically, it's something that, it basically just sort of says the same sort of thing that if you're into those sort of sci-fi films, the sort of things that you sort of would say about them. Because most sci-fi films, you know, fans, if they go to the conventions and everything, but some will take it like massively, massively serious. But most of them are sort of like, you know, are making fun as well. And I think it sort of it ties into that sort of like to the convention type you know fandom and stuff. And also I think it's got a really really good cast. You know the comedy elements are really great. You know I personally have a lot of time for that movie, and I think it's just sort of just a really really fun you know spoof on the whole sci-fi fandom, but also on sci-fi movies in general.
Okay.
I'm guessing I've not sold it onto you, have I?
No, it's one of these things where that's what I hear from the general pitch, but I think if I actually sit there and watch it myself now, maybe I'll get it, but I still don't see the appeal. It seems like it's an okay film, but it's one of these things, I guess it's better if I just sat down and watch it. Other notable entries on this list are Fight Club, Three awesome. Kings, Any Given Sunday.
That is a really great film.
Yeah.
You know, that is one when people talk about sport movies, or favorite sport, that always seems to get like sort of missed. And I think that's an excellent sport movie. You know, I think it's fantastic.
There's a film on here that I want to put a spotlight on, but I know once we get to the Razzies, I know they're going to spotlight it. And it's one of these things where you've mentioned when we do the Razzies, our guilty pleasure film. And I'm looking at it. You'll never guess what it is, but when we get to Raz, I'm sure it's going to make its way on there, and it's one of these films that is, in fact, a guilty pleasure, and I will defend that movie up and down. But
is it Deep Blue Sea?
No. Although, I will admit there...
Because I love Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah, I think you're going to get much criticism from me or anybody else. I'm not one of these things where it's not this fantastic movie, but
it's just,
I can appreciate it.
It's quite preposterous, though, because the idea is that they're going to cure Alzheimer's. And the thing, the animal that they're going to try and make super smart with this Alzheimer's drug is a great white shark. It's like, wouldn't you sort of try and make, like, I don't know, a tuna? Or a dolphin? Or a sort of, you know...
Yeah, a mammal!
Something peaceful. But like, you know, what shall we make really, really super smart? I know, a shark. Nothing will go wrong with that.
Well, there's no film there. If you...
Well, yeah, exactly. But yeah, but it's just like a preposterous type film. But yeah, the bit with Samuel Jackson when he gets...
That was great!
That was awesome. I did not see that coming. Because he makes this great speech, and then it just jumps out of the water.
In the middle of the speech, too! Or towards the end of it. It's like, you've never seen that from Hollywood, and it was like... It was so refreshing because you never see something like that. You're so used to the Hollywood schmoz thing where eventually he dies, or he dies valiantly trying to save everybody. It's like you never expect to see that right in the middle of a speech. And that was so great. I'm surprised we haven't seen more of that in Hollywood, to be honest.
Yeah.
All right, I think that's going to do it.
Okay, no, you're not telling me what this movie is.
You're going to wait. Do. You're going to sit there and contently wait, because I know when we get to the Razzie, I will bet my reputation on the idea that this makes its way to the Razzie. So you will simply have to sit pretty and wait. All right.
Okay.
That gives you something to look forward to as far as the show's concerned.
Can I just say what one film that I actually like, really liked from the list and got sort of quite... slaughtered, but well, not quite slaughtered, but it wasn't a particular favorite of a critic. End of Days.
Mm.
Hold on. No, I'm completely thinking of a different movie. Mm. I was thinking of Strange Days.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah, so Strange Days on the list?
It's not.
Forget what I said.
Hey, you fool!
Fool.
All right. Is there any more entries before we move on? I know I was getting ahead of myself here.
I'm just looking through the list. There's some there's a few good ones, but some really, really bad ones. I mean, the Inspector Gadget movie was awful. Eyes Wide Shut, I absolutely hated. I thought I was so self-indulgent.
It's something that it's not my my guilty pleasure. But Pokemon, the first movie.
Project, I think we've talked. Have we talked about that on the Halloween show?
What film now?
Blair Witch Project.
Yeah, we talked about that. But for folks that maybe necessarily didn't check out that show, do you want to?
I mean, I personally just that was a film that I thought was massively overrated at the time. It made me feel sick, not because it was scary, but just because of the whole camera angle thing. It just sort of. It was a film that was sort of, I think a lot of cinema goers hadn't seen. I'd actually seen films before that. It was sort of like the whole video caught on camera genre. I'd seen a few films, and it was just it was sort of different. But I just thought it was like when I walked away from it, it was like a really sort of like it wasn't for me an enjoyable movie experience.
I will admit it was from a marketing standpoint. I think that was an absolute game changer. It's one of these films where I was listening to a public radio, I guess you would say a radio documentary about it, or at least they were doing a segment about it. Just all the things that they would do to try to put over the film. They made up fake actors' names, and they had them either die or you would see their film credits. It would just end at Blair Witch Project. And I was like, wow. And this was the early days of the internet as well. Well, obviously it had been around for a while, but this was still sort of the caveman days, and they felt the need to make sort of this viral marketing where it had a website that went along with it, and it's really cool. It was one of these things that it was obviously sort of reminiscent of, I guess, like, you know, like the Matrix idea that it's this film that it's at least the way it was marketed was out thinking outside the box. It did all these things that really revolutionized the way you to promote a film. So I can admit, at least as far as that's concerned, I can appreciate the film, but yeah, I'm sort of there with you. What we wound up getting once we actually got to the theater was kind of underwhelming. Although at the same time, I can also appreciate it was sort of its own thing. And I guess you would hope in a vacuum you can sort of watch and just appreciate it for its face value. But it's one of these things to where it was seen sort of in the 90s as just like this great film, and it just really wasn't that. And then eventually it would spawn all these sequels, and they weren't good. So it's one of those things where maybe at the time I'd be hesitant to rip on this film, but in the years that fall, I could see why people would sour on this film.
Yeah, you're right. It was sort of, you know, it was a cheap film to make, and marketing wise, it was a film everyone was talking about.
Exactly.
You know, so it worked on that thing. So you can't sort of fault it, you know, for that. And you're right. It was creative in its use of the internet and the fact that there was a bit of a sort of like, is this real type thing that people have come up with and stuff. And it's like, you know, but it did become laughable, but a bit where it was sort of like when something scary was meant to be happening, it was like, what's that? What's that? What's that? Oh my God, what is that? And it's like, well, we don't know because we can't see because the camera's not pointed there. It's like, you know.
All right. I guess we'll try to put a positive spin, because now we have to try to put a happy face on this. Dazza, what do you think won Best Picture in the year that followed in the year 2000?
Okay, I've got to say, looking at it, I have absolutely no
idea. Oh, come on. I'm obviously looking at what we want here, but just it screams at you, especially I'll give you a hint. It's in the top 10, Dazza.
Is it American Beauty?
Yes, it's American Beauty.
Right, okay.
See how much of a no-brainer that was? You just looked at that top 10, it's like, okay, what won Best Picture? Okay, American Beauty.
Yeah, okay.
All right, we got that positivity. We got that pesky positivity thing out of the way. Let's go let's let negativity reign supreme with the 20th Golden Razzie Awards in the year 2000, based off of the films that came out in 1999. Dazza, I'm going to reveal my guilty pleasure, but first, you have to figure out which of these five films it is. Number one, from Columbia Pictures, we have Big Daddy, The Blair Witch Project, The Haunting, Wild Wild West, and Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace.
So which one that you actually like on that list?
Yes.
I'm going to go with Wild Wild West.
Yes. That also is our worst picture winner. I swear, both me and my brother, we don't agree on a whole lot, but we both will sit there and watch from beginning to end and love every single minute of it. Now, obviously, it's one of these films where I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I love the film, like it's one of my favorite films. It's one of these films I could sit there and watch, and it's an enjoyable film, and I don't get the people ripping on it. Like, I can see all the trappings. I can see there's things I can see why people wouldn't like it. It's sort of akin to Star Wars Episode One, where it's they throw a bunch of money at it. They get all these big actors and all these special effects, and they think that's enough for a movie. But I still think there's enough here between Kevin Kline and Will Smith, their repertoire, and I just think I feel like I'm losing you, Dazza. Am I losing you? Am I not convincing you Wild Wild West is a decent film?
I've seen Wild Wild West once, and it was one of these films I watched on video, and it was a film I was kind of... It was just kind of a film I watched. I didn't... It was one of these films that years later I found out there was so much hate for it. And it wasn't a film that I particularly thought was great, but it wasn't one that I was sort of thinking, oh, that's a load of crap.
It was just
a film that I kind of felt neither here nor there. Which is, I guess, a bad thing, because as a film lover, you know, I should get some sort of reaction to it. But I basically... It was just like a film that I watched and just found out. Yeah, I've seen that and moved on. I didn't really have any sort of wild opinions on it one way or the other.
Yeah, I'm sort of there with you, because it's like there was all this negativity that came out of it. And I sat there, and, you know, it's not one of these films where if I'm on a desert island and I have to pick 10 films, this isn't going to be on that list, or even the top 50. But if it's on and I got nothing better to do, I'm going to sit there and watch and enjoy myself. So soon, I'm going to sit there and genuinely enjoy Wild Wild West. Now, obviously, it's not one of these films where I'm going to, you know, attentively be paying attention to. Maybe I'll be straightening out my house or my room, but, you know, I could sit there and watch it and be entertained, maybe have it play in the background. I'm half paying attention to it. It's like, okay, this is a big blockbuster film. There's no real substance to it, but, you know, it's a fun film. All right, let's go down the list of worst actor, Adam Sandler, Big Daddy. I don't know where that's coming from. Obviously, he wasn't great in that film, but he was there. So how you can sit there and say Adam Sandler was bad in that film is beyond me. Heather Donahue.
Kevin Costner again. They hate Kevin Costner.
I can't wait till we get to the age of high-speed internet so we can get all this cattiness that you see on the list off the list. Because you look at some of these things, and obviously you're not going to go with the worst of the worst. You're not going to go with the worst film that came out this year that nobody watched. But at the same time, it's like, oh, we're going to put Kevin Costner in For the Love of the Game and Message in a Bottle. It's like, okay, you're clearly just picking on the guy, and it's not really fair. But at the same time, it's like, well, he's also ain't exactly setting the world on fire. But I get the feeling, like, I keep saying this, I keep putting it over. We're still in the year 2000, but eventually we're going to get that year where the internet's come and everyone's on it, and we're finally going to get that cattiness out of everybody's system.
Yeah, because the internet cured all that, didn't it? Once we got the internet, everything calmed down, and we got rid of cattiness, and there was no sort of trolling or anything like that.
Well, I get the feeling there's a lot of people's avenue to vent their frustration. And it's like, okay, some of these aren't really necessary. So I don't know.
Yeah, but a lot of people on the internet, they're just all following what what people tell them anyway. So, you know, it becomes the cool thing to sort of hate on things.
Like I mentioned, Heather Donahue in the Blair Witch Project as worst actress as Heather.
I just want to go back to the worst actor. I think that's unfair. Robin Williams in Bicentennial Man.
Yeah, he was nominated for it.
Yeah, I think it was really – when you consider as well the outfit he was wearing, to actually put in some sort of personality into that, I think that's unfair.
See,
Bicentennial Man, I've seen it, and I think that's a
fine – I'm shocked that wasn't a worst picture entry, because I'm looking at it here, and I'm like, I have no recollection of this film. And I look at it, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right, that horrifying monster that sort of looks like Robin Williams. I can't unsee it now, Dazza. It's going to haunt my dreams. Let's see. Other notable entries. Denise Richards as the great. I'll sit here and I can't defend her role in the film, but still, Christmas Jones is one of the best fictional names of all time. If you ever go to a hotel and you're curious if you see if I'm checked in, I'll be checked in as Christmas Jones. let's see. Ooh, worst supporting actor, Jar Jar Binks. That's justified.
Yeah.
Worst screenplay, worst original song, Wild Wild West. And worst director. Wow. And worst screen couple. Wow. It cleaned up in a big way. See, this is what I mean here. I won't sit here and defend Wild Wild West as this fantastic cinema piece, but, you know, for the hatred it gets, I feel like it's not really garnered.
It does seem to be getting, yeah, it does seem to be going, sweeping the board, as it was, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ooh, look, I'm looking at a couple of new entries here. We have four new entries. Worst actor of the century, worst actress of the century, worst picture of the decade, and worst new star of the decade. Do you want to do a gimmick where I list it off, or did you just want me to straight up list off?
I've actually got it here.
Oh, okay.
So I can see. Because this was basically the last year of the 20th century.
Yeah.
So they're basically doing the 20th century Razzies. So this is kind of the worst of the worst. So let's see what we've got here. Yeah, if you want to list off list them off, because this is history. Okay. 20th century is, you know.
Okay. So okay, you want me just do the I guess you would say the nominees and then do the winner, or should I just list off who won what award?
List off the winners.
Okay, so for worst actor of the century goes to Sylvester Stallone for and this is their quote: 99.5 of everything he's ever done. For worst actress of the century, Madonna for Body of Evidence, Shanghai Surprise, and Who's That Girl, and etc.
Worst that I will agree with.
Worst picture of the decade, Showgirls. I probably agree with that. Winner of 7 Razzies in 1995. And worst new star of the decade, Pauly Shore for Biodome, Encino Man, and Jury Duty. I don't know if I can necessarily agree with that when you have Dennis Rodman for Double Team and Simon Says. And Jar Jar Binks made its way late in the century. And Elizabeth Berkley for Showgirls. I would have gone with one of those entries over Pauly Shore. God bless Pauly Shore. I think I'm going to put him in the same category as Wild Wild West. He's not one of these people I would go out of my way. But if he's there and he's sort of... Obviously, these are, I guess you would say, leading man roles. But if he was in a film and he was there, I'd be like, okay, he's kind of entertaining. But to say he's the worst new star of the decade, that's not fair.
This must be a guy who was I do know him. Yeah. I was going to say somebody who's not sort of made his way over to the UK consciousness, but I think I do know him.
You don't know the Weasel?
No. I think basically if it was in the Jury Duty film that I'm thinking of, I always thought of him kind of like a more vicious version of Bill and Ted or Wayne's World.
Do you want me to play a little bit of Pauly Shore? Because I guarantee you've seen and heard Pauly Shore before.
Go on, then.
All right, let's see. Just see, because you're going to feel a little stupid now.
Let's see. Mark.
Cutie pie, right?
No, this is a compilation. I dare not do an impression of Pauly Shore just for my own sanity. But let's see if I can I'll try one more time before I give up the ghost. Let's try one more time from Encino Man. A scene called Squeeze the Juice.
Kashmir Rajneesh, is it how many minutes for the burrito again?
2 minutes.
1 minute. 1.5 minutes. Make up your melons.
So you've never heard of Pauly Shore?
I Look at the films he's been in. I know the guy, but I'm not that familiar with his stand-up or anything like that.
People would probably say you're better off, but
big name over here. So
people would say you're better off, but I'm like, he's good in small doses, but to make him the worst new star, I think is not really fair. All right. Since we're talking films, I know Dazza, you're a big movie buff. So have you watched any films between now and the last time we've done this segment?
Oh, I've seen a bunch of films.
Ooh, that's good. For the segment, anyway.
I went to see The Accountant.
How was that?
That was great.
you hesitated.
It's a really weird film because it just goes. This is a film I would love to have gone in not knowing anything about it, because if you watch the trailer, you get a little hint of the direction it goes in. But if you're actually watching the film, it starts off and it's almost like a. I guess the term would be autism exploitation, if that is even a thing, because it's basically about Ben Affleck basically grows up with kind of like an autism type syndrome, which seems to give him almost like superpowers type sort of thinking. You know, he can basically do jigsaws really, really quick. And he's got this thing that basically sort of, he's brought in like as a troubleshooter into this firm to basically weed, go through their accounts and try to find some irregularities. So he sort of starts off as a film in that way, but with like, there's a bit of a mystery about him going on at the same time. And then about halfway through the movie, it sort of changes tack and he suddenly becomes like this, He uses his autism. He's basically becomes this like super hitman who is able to basically just sort of go through buildings and basically just like, you know, take out entire groups of sort of armed men and stuff. And it just goes so over the top. But it's frankly great how it just changes from one film into another. But I personally really, really enjoyed it. I really got into the character. Your favorite, Anna Kendrick, was in it as well, and she was really good. They made a real good double act.
Wait, my favorite?
Yeah, I thought you really liked her.
I think you overestimate how much I like Anna Kendrick. Now, obviously, okay. I'm a fan of her work, but for me to say my favorite, it's like, that's okay. Being a little absurd.
I thought she was someone you were sweet on, let's say. So maybe I misjudged that.
You may have.
Okay. I may have. actually, Anna Kendrick actually reminds me of a girl I used to work with. So, which she's got like the kooky little thing going on and everything. So it's quite disturbing. But yeah, J.K. Simmons was in it, and was basically pretty much. I mean, you put him in a film, and you could have him just sat there reading pages from a telephone directory, and it'd be compelling. You know, the guy's awesome. John Bernthal was in there. It was just a really fun movie. I'm not sure. It's one of those films where you come away with it and you think, I'm not actually sure what they were going for in that film. There were a few things in there that were like really, really odd. Particularly how it seemed to like portray or autism as being this like sort of this thing that you've got autism, but you'll get some great benefits out of it sort of thing. It was just really, really strange in some respects, but I really enjoyed it. And there's also a great scene where if you're a comic fan, there's a little bit that you'll mark out for when he's going through his antique collection of things that he basically collects. There's a little scene in there that comic fans will enjoy. But yeah, but I really enjoyed that film. Went to see a film called Nocturnal Animals a couple of days ago, which was a thriller with Amy Adams and I can never say his name. Jake, what was his name?
The guy
who was in what do you call it? It was in Donnie Darko.
Oh, Jake Gyllenhaal.
Gyllenhaal, I can never pronounce that name. Jake Gyllenhaal. They were in a really, really good film, but I've never had a film that I watched that was really, really good that pissed me off so much. Basically, it's a really good concept. The idea is that basically Amy Adams gets a manuscript from her ex-husband, and he's written a novel. And so you've got the two storylines going on. You've got basically, you've got her storyline about her life. You've got the storyline flashbacks going back to her relationship with her husband. and what went wrong. But you've also got the storyline going up, because as she's reading the novel, you're basically sort of like, you know, that's dramatized for you as well. So you've got the three different storylines going on. And it's like a really disturbing story that this guy's written. And the all three things are actually really quite compelling. Jake Gyllenhaal, he basically stars as her husband, ex-husband, but he also stars as the main character in the novel. Mm. So, and the novel story is really great and really disturbing and compelling, as are all things. And as much as I love the film in some respects, I was expecting that there was going to be something that tied it all together in some sort of like, you know, really, you know, and I'm not saying that you should tie everything in a film together, but I was expecting that this was all leading to something. And it kind of didn't. And the kind of the ending was when the credits came up, I was like, oh, come on, that's it. What was that about? And it's one of these films that when you sort of sit back and think about it, and since it actually compelled me to read up on what other people thought about the ending and stuff. And I can understand there's a lot going on about how she reads from her reading the novel, how it changes her. Now she starts to look at other things and stuff. But I just kind of, I was expecting that there was a twist there that never came that I was expecting. I was expecting something sort of, you know, to tie the whole thing together, and that never came in a way. But even without that, it was a really, really good film, really atmospheric. You know, the story that she reads in the novel was absolutely, you know, fabulous. It was like, you know, but like I say, quite, you know, a really disturbing film, but, you know, one that I would actually sort of recommend, just sort of, you know, but if you're into your independent art house type movies, you will enjoy. Mm. And the last film to talk about, I went to see Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Mm-hmm. The other day. That film, I was kind of disappointed with it in many ways. I'm just to put it out there, as a Harry Potter, I guess I'd consider myself a Harry Potter fan, because I've read all the books and enjoyed them, loved some of them more than others. For the most part, I've watched all the films and I've enjoyed most of them. You know, there's a few that sort of, you know, that sort of went, particularly the earlier ones. But this one was sort of real looking forward to, because I thought this is going to be like a different, you know, set in the same world, but basically in set in America as opposed to the UK. And, you know, we're a new fresh take on everything. And there was some really good stuff in there. The stuff with the actual beat, it was actually surprising, because normally these films went with sort of the whole sort of, you know, with the idea of CGI, you know, creatures and everything, building a film out that I didn't think I was going to take to. Those bits were my favourite bits in the movie. There was some sort of like really magic, some real magic in there about them, particularly the scenes where there was a scene where he basically has like a like almost like a sort of a private zoo of all these sort of creatures, where he's sort of basically looking after them and stuff, and he's doing a tour of all the things. And it was really, really nice and magical. And, you know, and just sort of like, you know, really good. And the thing is, I think that there was a few things that basically put me off really enjoying this movie. But one of them was Eddie Redmayne's character, Nuke Scamander. I just couldn't take to the character. Mm. And I see what where they were going with this, with the character. I like what we're trying to achieve when we're basically, because basically his character was somebody who was very shy and uncomfortable around people. But when he was with the animals, he had a real sort of rapport with them, and that's where he came out of his shell. But I mean, but most of the film, he was sort of trying to avoid other people, sort of, you know, gazes and stuff. And he was, you know, but he actually addressed that, because there's one point in the film where he mentions that people find him annoying. But while I sort of get and appreciate what we're trying to do by, and this is comes from J.K. Rowling, who actually did, like, you know, write the script for that, but she's sort of trying to basically create a character who's a hero, but not necessarily like the confident hero that you see in films, but the idea that you can be, you know, worthwhile and a heroic person, but still be a flawed as a person, sort of thing. I can see what we're going for, but I just couldn't take to the character. Mm. There was basically like a foursome of the sort of who were like the main characters, and the two, the him and his leading lady, I just couldn't take to. The other two characters, I actually, who were like almost there for like the comedy and were sort of a lesson of the group, I actually sort of found their relationship a lot more moving. And, you know, and basically sort of more interested in them as characters as I was the main one. But there were some good things. Colin Farrell's great as a villain. but the whole, yeah, newsflash, but the whole story.
Sorry, that's a name I haven't heard in forever.
Yeah. The whole story, I just couldn't take to the whole story, to be honest. There were lots of elements that were sort of there. Like you had this group who were kind of like this prejudiced group who were basically trying to tell people that there were wizards amongst them, and were basically trying to like start a hate campaign and everything. And that story never really, really went anywhere. And there was also a guy who was like basically running for mayor of the city, and that storyline didn't go. There was stuff going on in the Wizarding community that basically just did it. And I don't know if it was sort of setting this up for further movies, but the story just didn't really sort of, you know, click with me. And like I say, it was nice seeing this world again. There was some really good moments to it, but generally speaking, the whole film, I just couldn't really sort of take to a extent that I actually sort of did get quite bored in a few places, and the action at the final battle scenes at the end, to be honest, he reminded me of the Avengers in the fact it was basically big battles going on, New York getting trashed. The only thing is with this one that didn't really work for me is everything was meant to be sort of like, you know, but the thing with the Harry Potter films is they sort of work because all the magic and all the battles and everything take place far away from cities. So you've still got that hidden society thing. In this film, you've basically got New York being trashed and people firing wands at each other and everything. And yet everything goes, they basically manage to sort of like, you know, rectify it so no one remembers and stuff. It just, that whole thing, you know, those things, I mean, didn't really, really work for me. And I've got to say, as a franchise, I've seen this. Like I say, I was mixed feelings with bits of it, enjoyed or everything, but I personally, unless there's something like really, really enticing in the future films, this isn't something I'm going to really rush to see anymore in this series.
Yeah, when I heard about this film, I thought, it's like, she's going back to that well again, huh? Or at least she's attempting to branch out, but it's like, I feel like I've had my fill with her for quite a while. I'm sure she has quite enough money where she probably doesn't need to write or work another day in her life. But that's just me.
I think, to be honest, this is a thing where you're right. She doesn't need the money. I think with a lot of these, and she's probably, I mean, obviously a little bit more money never hurt anybody, as Larry Holmes said. But I think she is actually doing this because she has a real love of this world. You know, she's created this world. It's something that there's some people that when they're doing something, you can tell when they're really invested and passionate about something. And so it's sort of, even though she doesn't have to, she could easily basically just put, you know, market out her name, you know, take this and say, look, this is the Harry Potter world. Warner Brothers, you do what you want with it. But, you know, she wants to basically, you know, carry on, you know, making this world. So, you know, you can't really fault her for that. And there are sort of like, you know, there are really, really good elements in there that she brought to it. It just, for me, this one didn't basically entice me. It didn't reinvigorate my affection for that world. It just sort of, you know, it would just kind of, you know, If they do make another one, which for World Cup, it's going to be a box office thing, I'm not going to be rushing out to see it.
Okay, anything else you've been watching?
Film-wise, they're the main three. Have you been watching Westworld, by the way?
No, but I've heard about it. The premise is kind of cool, but I'll say it. I don't see how this has legs as far as, unless you're going to radically change the show. I don't see how you can get multiple seasons out of this. I don't know. Have you been watching it, Des? I presume you did.
I've been watching it, and I basically, I've liked bits of it, but the thing is, this is a thing that everyone seems to be absolutely loving. The majority of people that I sort of know or read are basically really invested with this. They're basically, they're invested to a level of people who were invested of Game of Thrones and Lost and trying to, you know, and I personally haven't taken to it that well. I love the stuff that's going on in the park. The stuff with all the cowboys and everything and their sort of storylines in there. I've loved all that. Well, enjoyed all that stuff. But the stuff that happens in the lab, which is a key point to what's going on and everything, I've just found my attention drifting massively.
I feel
to the extent that even I was sort of like, a scene will go by and I've basically, the way that they do dialogue and everything and the way that the scientists talk to the robots and everything, I just find so dull and metaphysical gargle that I just basically just found myself afterwards thinking I've no idea just what went on in that scene. and that seems to be and a few other people have agreed with me, but generally speaking I've just sort of, I think there is legs on it with where they're going, because this season there's hints that where the future seasons are gonna go and directions that sort of, you know, that there's sort of, you know, there's obviously a conspiracy going on. And this is sort of an idea that it's going to branch out to other worlds, possibly. But generally speaking, I've been following it, but I don't know if I'll basically be around for season two. It's just sort of, you know, the cowboy stuff's great, but I've just not been that enamored with it enough to the level that other people are.
I think it's a cool premise. I like the idea, but to me, something like that would probably be better suited for a film. Like, I can see you telling a 2.5 hour story of what seems to be the premise of this series. I feel like it'd be better suited for something like that as opposed to what we actually have now. It's like, okay, it's a great show. I could see maybe 3 seasons tops. But after a while, it's like, well, eventually you're going to have to pull the trigger and I don't know if they'd be willing to do that, especially when you consider, well, where do you go from there?
Yeah.
But that's
Coughlin's got into it.
Yeah, he kept mentioning something, MIB, and I'm like, what the hell is he talking about? He's certainly not talking Men in Black, so I had to do a Google image search with the names he was mentioning in MIB. It's like, oh, okay, Westworld, okay, now I'll get it.
But people have these, like, massive, massive debates about what it all means and everything. And I'm watching it and just think, I just can't be bothered with this, with the debate. I'm not getting this sort of the intrigue. And I was one of these people that was like, I would spend hours in the days of Lost, going through the numbers and see if I could find any pattern and stuff and watching the TV and looking for clues and everything. So I am quite open to that sort of like obsessiveness. But Westworld, for whatever reason, hasn't caught it for me.
I think you nailed it on the head when you said there's a certain hole that left with Game of Thrones going off season, and that sort of filled the hole for a lot of people. Even though, and obviously, I'm going to continue sort of with the hole and puzzle analogy. It was something that it didn't quite fit. The hole left by Game of Thrones, and people are trying to make more of what this series actually is. That's not to rip on this series, and then probably I'll get around to watching it because it actually looks fairly decent enough. But I'm just, okay, great premise. For what I've seen so far, I like what I've seen, what I've heard. But at the same time, it's like, well, I'm probably going to enjoy it for about a season or two, and then I think it's going to outwear its welcome. Because it's like eventually there's only going to be so many stories you're telling, and if they just want to hang on to the success of it, I think they're going to wear out its welcome. But and I think that's what ultimately is going to happen. But it's one of these things where maybe if I sit down and watch it, I can kind of see where they can go. But at the same time, it's like, well, I can only see my interest in this lasting for so long before it begins to wane. All right, since we talk all things cinema, Dazza, have you been reading anything as of late that you want to talk about with the folks?
A couple of things that I've been reading. One of them actually just finished today. Rogue One Catalyst, a novel, mm-hmm. which is basically the prequel to the the Rogue One film that's coming out in a couple of weeks, which I've already got my ticket for. I'm really excited. I've got a early morning showing, so I'll be able to have a nice breakfast and then go to watch Star Wars. Really good novel. Really different. One thing I've actually, since the sort of the whole Star Wars thing came back, one thing that has really benefited is the actual novels. Because before, the novels was kind of fun, but there was also that thing that they weren't canon. Whereas all the novels now that are coming out are actually canon, and so they actually fit in with the films. And this one was, I really enjoyed. It was very different from a lot of the Star Wars novels I've read in the past, because it was really more story and character based. It is basically everything about the family that are involved in the creation of the Death Star, and how the Death Star it basically sort of takes you how the Death Star actually, you know, came about, all the politics and the shenanigans behind the scene that were going into making of it, and it's just a really, really cool story. And just like I say, it's pretty much all character based. You know, there is a few action scenes in there, but there's a lot of tension as well, because it's all about how the how the Empire rise and how they were basically sort of tightening their grip and everything, and sort of and bringing everything under their control, and just a really, really enjoyable novel. I breezed through it. It is one that I would recommend. Before, it makes me even more excited to go see Rogue One. But the cool thing about it is there's nothing in there that does that. I was a bit dubious about reading it, because I thought, is this going to spoil things for the film? And it doesn't. It just basically, I think if you go watch the film, you won't necessarily miss out by not reading the novel if you just want to watch the film. But I think it's got me already into the characters, so I know the backgrounds, everything. I know some sort of backstory. So yeah, that's one I would really, really recommend. Okay. And the other thing that I just want to talk about that I've read, I managed to get around to reading the Mockingbird by Chelsea Kane. I got the first volume collected. Basically, because of the sort of the very strange controversy that came out on Twitter to do with this book, I heard a lot about it. I read a lot of reviews. I heard some good things. I heard some bad things, and I just wanted to make up my mind myself by giving it a try, and I'm kind of underwhelmed.
I think the controversy came from the last issue's cover, because really I'm sort of there with you, where it's a so-so title. Like I mentioned in the Comic Conversation show, I felt like it was a series just because they featured art on the Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. show, so obviously they had to try to create some synergy with the comics, which very rarely ever works. And I feel like this was just another victim of that. It's like, well, they introduced her on the show, so they felt the need to make a book. And this is obviously a character that's been around the Marvel Universe for quite a while. But, you know, it's one of these characters, it's like, I don't know if there was a series there. Just because there's not a lot to go with, but at the same time, it's even if it was particularly good, she's such a C-list character. It wouldn't have done her any good had the series been good. But for when I read it, it was all right. It was okay. I think the big controversy became the cover of the last issue. Because, and it's one of these things where, yeah, it was canceled because it was just a so-so series that sold not too well. So I understand. I don't think there's any controversy behind that. I think it just became one of these things where there was a controversy over the cover. And the people that felt like defending it felt like defending the book, even though they really didn't have a much ground as far as a quality of the title. And the people that were enraged by the cover, I also felt like they didn't have really a leg to stand on as far as, why are you ripping on this just because of a cover? It's like, it's a series that's getting canceled, and I know there's a bit of a second life to a degree of it with the trade selling well on Amazon, but it's like, okay, that's great. Fine for her, fine for Marvel. She'll probably come back with a better title, and we'll see. Maybe if she learns how to step up her game, she could probably, if they give her a really good character, she could probably do something really good. But I don't see what the big thing is, and it's one of these things where I obviously, since I'm a pro wrestling fan, obviously I think everything, there's a work, there's an angle to everything. So I'm one of these people that thinks, okay, you've managed. I think this whole controversy is sort of just made up. Because really, aside from what I see online, I don't know anybody that defends this title.
Yeah, I mean, the controversy that I sort of picked up on this was the story got on that Chelsea Kane, the writer. Oh, incidentally, she I read a novel of hers a few years ago, which was really, really good. So I sort of know the author anyway. She's a good writer. But the controversy came up when she basically mentioned that she was going to sort of possibly leave Twitter because she basically started getting harassed by a few people when her book was cancelled. Now, the thing is, immediately, and this is a sort of big, like, White Knight thing, loads and loads of people in comics and fans all of a sudden started this massive campaign, sort of like, support Chelsea Kane, and people were basically sort of doing like news article on the internet how she was being harassed and forced off Twitter and stuff. And also to reading these things, I thought, they're not giving any examples of what the harassment actually is. And Chelsea Kane actually came back and she actually said that she'd it had been exaggerated a lot because she said that she'd had a few, several people basically sort of like, harassing her a little bit about the book and basically mocking her because the book had been cancelled and stuff. But she said that, she'd not had sort of like, threats or anything like that she said it was a small number that was sort of basically like trolling her, but she said it wasn't like him, the masses, but she basically decided to basically walk away from Twitter anyway, because she just thought even a few is sort of like enough. And I have some sympathy for her, because the thing is, reading it, it's obviously that this is a series that she believed in and that she wanted to do something different, with the character and stuff. And I personally, the things I liked about the book, I liked the fact that the first issue was sort of like, you had several sort of like lead-ins to stories later, but you basically got the stories in the later issue. So like when she was coming back from a mission and once she had a corgi, and when she came back, she had like a dominatrix outfit on. And then when you read the later issues, you find out what the missions were. Unfortunately, the stories that they actually were told, I personally didn't really care for that much. And also, it was one of these things that this sort of like really irritates me about some comics, in that pretty much every line of dialogue was basically trying to be a gag. It's like, I love my comedy comics. I love Howard the Duck. I love Gwenpool. But the thing is, in those comics, even though there's sort of a lot of humor and gags in there, not every panel is a gag. There's lots of pages where they're basically just having regular conversations. And you have people who are basically, everybody that she seemed to meet in this comic was basically some, and every conversation was meant to be some sort of gag and some sort of, funny line and stuff. And I just didn't, it's one of those things that gets nauseated. Even when she was sort of like in battle and stuff, when she's fighting AMA agents and stuff like that, it just got nauseating. The funny thing is that in this collection that I've got, we've got the first, I think it's five issues of the series. It also has the special that was basically actually predated the other ones, the first one that Chelsea Kane read. And that story, I actually really, really enjoyed. If I'd have read that first, I would have thought, this is like a really good series. And I think the thing I liked about it is that, putting aside the whole sort of like, the whole sort of, feminist, thing about it, the fact is that she was basically a character who was basically throughout this was like one step ahead of the bad guy. And a lot of sort of like, superheroes, whether they're male, female, whatever, the superheroes is normally like reactive and normally get sort of double cross, to basically sort of make a comeback at the end, as it was, to use a wrestling terminology. In this one, it turns out she's actually ahead of the game. She's one step ahead of the villain. She sort of has everything figured out and is luring him into a trap. And I kind of liked that intelligence in there. I just thought that when it came to the regular series, it just sort of, it became sort of like, nauseating. And the thing is, but in the end, when you talk about the people, like, and when I did actually do a search on Twitter, I did find quite a lot of people reacting to the cover of that she's got a t-shirt that says, "Ask me about my feminist agenda," and people taking offense to that. And you know, the sort of, and quite a few people using the opportunity to basically sort of, you know, do some attacks on Mockingbird and the series. The thing is, at the end of the day, if you don't like a series and you don't like what a particular creator is doing, then just move on to something else. You know, I can't think that there's that Mockingbird is that big of a fan base that people will be massively, massively like appalled at what she's done with the character. She believed in what she was doing. She did a series her way and it just didn't find an audience. And so it got cancelled. It's as simple as that. To me, there's no need ever to basically, you can go on Twitter and basically say you hate the Mockingbird series and everything and sort of, you know, but to actually engage with the creator and basically sort of, especially when the creator's book has already been cancelled, why you would basically try to rub salt in somebody's wound and sort of something that they obviously took a lot of care and actually believed in, you know, that's something that isn't necessary. If somebody's wrote what you think is the worst comic in the world, I personally don't think that gives you any call to actually attack the creator directly. You know, just ignore that comic, you know, vote with your money and go and buy something else instead. But that's to me is a, you know, better use of your time. But but personally, the Mockingbird series, you know, it was okay, but I just sort of, it wasn't something that I kind of went in there hoping that I'd sort of read it and really enjoy it and be sort of like, you know, oh, it's a shame the series is cancelled, but I'm kind of nonplussed about it personally.
Yeah, and as far as criticism, you're always going to get that. I don't care if you're a woman writer or a man writer. You're always going to get criticism. You're always going to have people, you know, criticize your work, saying it's terrible. And you're always going to have people that take it a little bit too far. You just have to learn to live with it. And I mean, that comes with the territory and the idea that she seems, like you said earlier, she was sort of quick to say it was sort of blown up, but it's like, okay, that's fine. And I can sort of, I see where she's coming from now, because I never got that part of the story. I just got the outrage. So I didn't get the entire picture, but still at the same point, it's like you put yourself out there in the public and with your, you know, the fact that you're a writer, it's like, you're going to get these people that don't agree with this, whether or not it's good. You're always going to get people that are criticized no matter how good it is. And when you have criticism, especially in the age of Twitter and Facebook, you're always going to have people that take it way too far. So the idea of you're going to get off Twitter because of that, it's like, well, you're not doing yourself any favors. You're always going to get that. And if something like that's going to sort of sway you to one way or another as far as what you do, then maybe this isn't the industry for you, because it's like you sort of are on a pedestal here, and you have to be willing to take the good with the bad. And it's like, oh, I have some criticism that I feel isn't fair. It's like, well, join the club. Everyone's got that. It's like, Just learn the roll with the punches. Keep doing what you're doing. Eventually, you'll find an audience, and you'll make something that people like, and then that'll be the end of the day. And no matter how good something is, you're always going to have people criticizing or critiquing it, or maybe some people just aren't going to get it. They're just going to say, "I don't get it. I don't like this. I don't think it's very good."
Yeah, but there's the difference, though, between critiquing and criticizing, and people just being downright abusive. Which is what, you know, that
I can speak, you know, to personal experience, because I do a podcast with a man who's threatened the life of Brian Michael Bendis. So the idea, because she's a woman, it's like, it doesn't make any difference. I've seen it firsthand, and it's like, okay, you're always going to have that element of people that take it way too far. And maybe sometimes they're playing it for gags, but maybe sometimes they're in that moment, they kind of feel it, but you know, they're not going to act on it. So it's like, whatever. That's the internet in 2016. You're going to have people run the gamut of just people that love your work and think you can do no wrong, and people that hate your guts and hope you die. It's like, you're always going to get that, and that's part of the game. And to pretend like, well, she's a woman, she should be treated delicately because she's a woman in the comic book industry, and we should celebrate her regardless if her work is good or bad. It's like, no, she should be treated just like any other person in the comic book industry. She's going to have her critics out there, and she should just learn to tough it up.
No, I'm not saying, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that because she's a woman, she should be protected. I'm saying that basically all creators should be treated with, you know, a fair degree of respect. You don't have to make things personal. You can go on Twitter and basically, all you have to do is basically, you know, go on message boards and discuss stuff, go on like Twitter and discuss stuff, but you don't have to basically go to the person directly. And attack them. and make things personal that way. I disagree with him there, but you know, there's no use of that. I personally can't stand Rob Liefeld and what he did to some of the comics that I loved, but I would never basically think of them going onto his Twitter and basically saying, "You're an arsehole. I hope you get cancer. I hope your kids die. I'm going to fuck your wife and basically make you watch because I hate the comics that you do." You know, I'm not going to do that. It's, you know, I'll go on a message board and slag the guy's work off constantly, but I would never make it personal and confront him, you know, with that. I just don't, there's no reason to basically sort of, you know, and some people, the thing is, one of the things that she did say is that she's been writing novels for years and years, and she's never had any sort of, like, you know, abuse. She's wrote comic books, and now she's starting to get them. I just, there is a sort of a nastiness in sort of, in certain fandoms, and some of it is directed at women because they don't think that women should be in the comic industry or that sort of thing, you know. So, I personally don't think, you know, I will never excuse or basically think that sort of saying something is the way it should be because it's just sort of like, oh, it's the internet, you've just got to, you know, live with that. That's kind of like saying that, you know, sort of people can go into... people don't, you know, come into my shop and because I work behind the counter, that they can basically just, like, you know, send a load of abuse my way, you know, and think I have to take it. Which some people, believe it or not, some people actually do.
You better hope I never go to the UK, Dad. That's the worst. Yeah. First thing I'm going to do, I'm going to find out where you work and I'm going to give you a hard time. I wish you had never met me because I could have just given you a hard time and you would have been like, yeah, Tony, there was this guy at my work who was giving me a hard time. You said you were in the UK?
Yeah, but I know what you look like, you idiot.
That's why I said I wish I'd never seen me. Right. So I could have gone to your store and given you a hard time, and then you could have told me all about it on Skype.
Oh, yeah.
You would have been better even on the show.
Yeah, I don't think you could hide your voice that well.
Okay, is there anything else you've been checking out besides Mockingbird?
There's a comic I'm reading at the moment that I've actually not finished, so I want to basically wait until I've actually finished it before I discuss it.
I'm just curious now. You piqued my interest.
It's Miracle Man.
Oh, I envy you. I wish I could go back and read Miracle Man for the first time.
Yeah, I want to read the whole lot. It's weird. It's one of these comics that I really should have read like years and years ago, but I've just never got around to it. It's like a really sort of, you know, obviously it's Alan Moore, even though it just says the creator on the comic. Which is, you know, because he doesn't want his
name
on it.
The original creator. So. That's what they credit.
The original creator. Yeah. So, you know, it's obviously Alan Moore, but yeah, it's one I'll be, I'll discuss more when I've actually, finished reading it. Just trying to think what else I've, been reading. I really enjoyed the Star Wars one this past week.
After Vader, I stopped reading all those Star Wars comics. So maybe you can tell me what I'm missing out on then.
The latest saga that they've been doing is there was a storyline where the rebels have stolen a Star Destroyer, and they've come up with an elaborate plan to get control of a Star Destroyer so they can break this Imperial blockade. But there's this elite group of stormtroopers who have been dispatched to basically sort of track down, you know, Luke and his band and everything. And just because stormtroopers are pretty much sort of like almost a joke in most Star Wars things. They're basically just there as sort of like, they're only really good as very sort of there in numbers. Whereas this team, each one of them has, they're almost like a Mission Impossible team. You know, each one has their own sort of thing that they bring to the unit, and we're just like a really good crack unit. And we just have this like the battle with them and the rebels on the Star Destroyer. But there was one that was like real proficient in using lightsabers because he grew up in like as a slave in this gladiatorial arena. So he was real good at hand-to-hand combat, and he managed to get into a fight with Skywalker. There was one guy who was basically like, you know, was the heavy of the team, and he actually held his own in a fist fight with Chewbacca. It's just been like a really cool, you know, story. But sort of, you know, but this like real legitimate tangible threat that they've gone. It's just one that I've really, really enjoyed as a saga lately.
Okay, maybe I've been quick to judge these Star Wars comics, so maybe I'll check that out then.
Okay.
I think that's going to do it for this week's show. Well, actually, you know what? I always forget to do this. Daz, is there anything that you've been writing that you want to that I've either made its way to halfguard.com that you want to plug here, or is there something you've been working on as of late that you want to talk about?
There is, and it should be coming up in a day or so. I did the first draft of it today, and I'll be hopefully getting it up in a couple of days. I've just done a little bit of it, not an in-depth preview, but just something building up the Suicide Squad versus Justice League series that's coming up in December. It's basically just a little piece from me of why I'm really excited about this series and why it basically just brings me back to the days when the sort of the whole versus thing used to be a really, really big deal. You know, and it's just the things of why this is a sort of series that sort of is basically obviously geared towards like, you know, being very fan pleasing. But I know some people will basically roll their eyes at the whole concept of it and stuff. So it's basically me saying why I'm looking forward to it and why I think it's like a really well worked idea. But why it works on so many levels, and also just sort of go back in time and just sort of look at in the past of how this sort of book, it was at one point, you know, the staple of the comic industry, because everything was to basically do with the big sort of fights and all the, you know, the matchups and everything, and just how things have changed. But even in today's where I sort of like talk about how, even though I appreciate how great comics are writing, you know, when you've got a great series like Vision, you know, which is sort of, you know, sort of groundbreaking and sort of so imaginative, so many levels, it's still the one thing I never want to lose in comics, and I never want to lose as a comic reader, is that I can still find absolute joy by seeing that there's a series coming on something as just as simple as two teams are going to meet and going to fight. And that's something that I never want to lose as a fan. And it's just basically, the article is basically me just sort of hyping of, you know, what I think is going to be a pretty cool way to round off a new year.
Okay. There you go. All right. I think that's going to do it for this week's show, unless there's anything else you very quickly want to talk about, Dazza.
No, that's pretty much it.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's show. So from all of us at halfguard.com, thanks for checking out this week's show. And as always, check you guys out next week. Adios.